The ETF Edge podcast is sponsored by Invesco QQQ, supporting the innovators changing the world. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Welcome to ETF Edge, the podcast. If you're looking to learn the latest insights on all things exchange-traded funds, you are in the right place. Every week, we're bringing you interviews, market analysis, and breaking down what it all means for investors. I'm your host, Bob Pisani. New funds offer ways for hungry investors to get in on private tech companies, but is it possible to democratize the process even further? Here's my conversation with Brett Winton, Chief Futurist at ARK Investment, Howie Nigg, Head of Analytics and Investment Solutions at Forge Global, and Nicholas Colas from DataTrek. Brett, I'll start with you. You and Kathy Wood launched the ARK Venture Fund in 2022. This is an interval fund. It also invests in private tech companies like SpaceX, OpenAI, and Epic Games. And it also owns public companies like Coinbase and Robinhood. Now, you just published a paper that caught my eye claiming that this interval fund is a better way to invest in private companies. Can you explain why you think it's a better way?
Yeah, actually, interval funds were designed specifically to allow everyday investors to invest in less liquid assets. And venture fits right into that idea. So with an interval fund, you don't have to be an accredited investor. You don't have to be very, very wealthy to invest in venture exposures like OpenAI, and you get to invest at the net asset value. So you can buy daily at the value of the underlying positions in the portfolio, and then you can sell quarterly. And so you have a quarterly window in which you can kind of sell your position.
And I want to, this is a good educational moment to inform viewers what an interval fund is. So with an interval fund, you can buy at any time at the net asset value. That's the key. So there's no premium or discount. And you can sell to the company at set times on a quarterly basis. Am I right about that?
Exactly. And so that's why it's an appropriate vehicle for illiquid assets, because it allows for kind of the manager to prepare for the redemptions that come and make sure there's a pool of liquid assets that they can sell to meet those redemptions, and those happen quarterly.
So, and you own private and public companies. Why does the fund own both private and public companies? Like you own Coinbase, for example.
Yeah, the majority of the fund is in private companies, so roughly 80%. And then the public equities in the fund is to facilitate that quarterly redemption process. You know, frankly, it's an amazing time to invest in innovation, and we think both venture exposures and public innovation companies are incredibly well valued today to take a long-term investment over what's a unique decade in technological economic history.
Okay, Howie, let me turn to you. Private funds for qualified investors are also available. Forge Global recently launched the Forge Acuity Private Market Index. This is a market capitalization weighted index that tracks the performance of 60 late stage venture backed private companies, for example, like SpaceX and Epic Games. And I know you told me this is already being used in a private fund. Tell us about this private fund. Who is qualified to invest in it?
Right. So as a data provider and also as an index provider, liquidity provider in the space, we just see all these different types of fund structure coming to the space, which is very exciting. And I think very similar to the interval fund structure, the private fund is catering, it has a very similar redemption and contribution window. So you do transact at net asset value on a quarterly redemption basis. And I think for this fund, it is targeting institutional investors. So it's set up to take contribution from qualified purchasers, which are $5 million of net worth, and you just have to qualify to invest in the fund.
And so qualified investors here are net worth of at least $5 million. And what's the ticket size? I mean, it's totally institutional, right?
The ticket size is $100,000 at this point. Down the road, it might get revised up. The idea about the private fund with qualified QP, qualified purchasers, is to target the institutional segment. I think for any kind of asset class to mature, you're going to have retail players and institutional players at the same time. For this one, it's just the first step that we actually see index investing, and we're targeting, the fund manager is targeting the institutional segment.
Right. I mean, the obvious problem here with qualified investors is they cut out essentially the retail investors, yep. right? I mean, I assume, Howie, that was obviously a conscious decision on your part, right?
Yeah, it's definitely a conscious decision on the asset manager's path. But if you sort of think about the next product and more products coming to the space, the idea here is that now it's possible for you to invest like an index discipline, just similar to the public market, right? So this index is now launched for the first ever pure play institutional index fund. That's not to say down the road, we won't see products that actually cater to the retail segment, but it's still index tracking.
So Nick, let me bring you in here. This highlights the fundamental problem here. Investors want access to these hot private tech companies, and it's really hard to do that. So isn't the solution here to get more companies to go public long term? I mean, you're the old wise man here. Tell us what is your sense of watching this? Oh, people want these things and they can't get to them.
Yeah, it's funny because IPOs, the IPO window is what we call it on Wall Street, when a company can go public, when even the hottest company can go public, but even smaller ones, it opens and closes over time. The IPO window was last opened at the very beginning of 2022, and then it shut hard, and it hasn't reopened since. We've only seen a couple of interesting IPOs this year. There were very few last year. So as you said, there's a mismatch between investor interest in owning public companies and the ability of companies to actually go public in a relatively productive way, and that mismatch is exemplified by needing these kind of products.
So Howie, you said you imply somehow there's gonna be something coming down the road catering to retail investors. What is it? Is it an interval fund like Kathy has and Brett has here? What's going to come down the road that you have planned?
No, I think the interval fund that Kathy has is actually a very sort of reasonable next step, you know, other than these close-end exchange-traded close-end fund, which is the fund that you're referring to at the outset. So I think interval fund is definitely a possibility. And down the road, there might be other ways to access this as well before we even get to, say, like a 40-Act ETF wrapper.
Yeah. Brett, this is an ETF show, and so I know the viewers are wondering, why can't we just deal with this problem and create an ETF that holds the shares of these private companies? It seems, in terms of how you want to do this, that'd be the best way to address the issue. Why can't we do that?
Well, it comes down to the kind of liquidity and ability to access the underlying exposure. So you can't just invest in a private company without getting the permission of the company to invest in it. And that's an area where we do a lot of work, and actually we have an advantage because we're so, you know, well embedded in the technology community to be able to approach these companies and both provide them with information and then you know, invest direct on the cap table of these companies. And so if you had an ETF that had to accommodate daily inflows and outflows, it would be very difficult to actually have those assets be automatically deployed into the exposures that you are promising to your end investors.
So there's the problem. You know, I mean, to me as an ETF guy, gee, wouldn't that solve the problem? But there's not enough liquidity to be able to pull that off, and you've got to go to the companies and invest in the shares. You can't do it. So long term, you're the wise man here. What do we do to get these companies to stop sitting private for so damn long and go public so people can access? People want to get access to SpaceX, and you know, the company sits out there quite happy.
Yeah, I'd say two things. The first is we need a stable market for the rest of the year, and there'll be more IPOs. SpaceX may go next year. Who knows when OpenAI goes, or maybe there's a liquidity event. But it's going to be a runway. It's going to take some time. The second is, I think the public is now so much more in tune with understanding the power of disruptive innovation that the next raft of companies will come in right behind these. Once these go public, we'll get excited about the next ones. So I think this is going to be a perpetual problem because these companies won't go public as soon as people want to own them.
And Howie, you're sort of one of the experts. I talk with you often about IPOs. What will force more companies to go public? Is it higher interest rates? I mean, a lot of these companies are sitting around 10, 15 years old already. They're middle-aged, essentially. What is your thoughts on that process?
I think very similar to see the market situation of the public market. I mean, first of all, I do think that companies are actually staying private longer. So like it or not, there is going to be like, you know, your guest was just saying that there's going to be a new batch of company that's going to fill the spot of the SpaceX of the world that have actually gone public. So I think the trend of companies staying private longer is definitely there. Now, the companies moving onto the public market and therefore sort of enjoying all the benefits of the public market is largely a function of how the public equity market is actually behaving, what kind of valuation can they fetch, the interest of the environment, the macro environment, to your point.
Yeah. Brett, is this a structural problem? By structural, I mean, do companies want to stay private longer, not just because they get new funding, but because they don't want to deal with the regulatory burdens of going public? They don't want to deal with the scrutiny, the quarterly reports. Is there a problem with the way the legal requirements of going public? I'm trying to figure out other reasons besides, oh, interest rates are, you know, too high, or we're happy because we're getting funding, or the market's not right. Is there another reason that's preventing all these companies that sitting out there for years and years from going public?
Yeah, I mean, there are compliance and kind of like legal burdens, like to being in the public markets. I think that actually most public shareholders are not long-term enough focused, and that serves as both like unneeded near-term pressure on companies and can sometimes distract them from what they should be doing to differentiate themselves over the long term. And so we, as you know, a manager both in the public and private markets, our emphasis has been we are investing in innovation over the long term and going to support management teams even as they make their way into kind of the public market journey to make long-term decisions that are in the best interest of the company and the long-term investors. And I think that's a real challenge. A lot of public market investors don't have that long-term view.
Yeah, he's certainly right about that. But my point is, I remember the 1990s, and a lot of companies went public very fast. And the criticism was, oh, they were incredibly volatile because they didn't have much of a track record. And yet, given a choice of having that, I would rather have that than this, where we have companies that are middle-aged that are still up, you know, look how old Reddit was before it went public. You know, that's a long, long time to sit in the private market.
Another explanation could be that the challenges these companies are solving require a lot more capital than the dot-com bubble companies did. And so they require a lot more capital. It's much easier to go to a VC and have them write a bunch of checks as a mid or as a Series C, Series D, and keep the company growing, rather than go to the public markets and say, okay, do an IPO, then do a secondary 2 years later, and do another one 2 years after that. It could just be these company managements prefer the structure of going to the venture capital community, who, as Brett said, do understand the challenges, do understand you've got to hold for a couple of years and are going to be patient through their process, rather than going to the public markets and ask for those continuous rounds of fundraising to get to the end goal.
So Howie, you're sort of an expert on what's going on with venture capital. Where are all the the VCs? Where are they at the point where we've got to get these companies out there? We need more dry powder, we need to cash in, or are they able to do some, you know, buyout where the company itself or other venture capital people essentially buy them out of early stage investing? Where are we in this whole game?
I think we definitely have been seeing things have started to turn around, because if you're focusing on the late stage pre-IPO set of companies, if you look at the Forge Private Market Index, you know, one indication is that we have started to trend positive this year. The last 2 years have been negative. So I do think that you're seeing to see interest going back into the private market. As companies starting to go public, there will be new companies to replenish the inventory, so to speak. So things are definitely turning better, and the access to capital is actually becoming easier.
Brett, just let me go back to the ARK Venture Fund. Give us a sense of how you pick the funds here, the stocks here, the companies. I see Epic Games, 8%, Freenome, Relation Therapeutics, 6%, Anthropic, there's an AI play, 5%, SpaceX is about 5%, Databricks is about 4%. How do you and Kathy sort of come up with this stew of companies, and how do you decide which is weighted more or less?
Yeah, so we believe that this is a unique time in technological economic history, and that there are five major technology innovation platforms that are entering the marketplace at the same time: robotics, AI, multi-omic sequencing, public blockchain, and energy storage. And that's the framework by which we approach these companies. So our analysts are, I think, best in the world on technology, and then we select the companies we want to invest in, and talk to them and then write checks.
And what can you explain the fee structure for this? Because sometimes it gets a little complicated. What's the, when you own this, what's the fee structure?
Well, I'd refer you to the prospectus. It's 2.75 in the prospectus, and investors pay no more than 2.9%.
Okay. Where do you think this is all going to go? Besides just whether SpaceX, we can speculate whether SpaceX is going to go public this year or next year, what's going to happen, who knows what Elon Musk is thinking right sure. now, but where is this ultimately going to go? My hope is this is it, that we are seeing IPOs starting to come, and we're going to get a flood of IPOs this year. We've had $1 billion to $2 billion in the last few weeks. We're going to get the next few weeks. It's almost like 2019 again, when things were really opening up. Who knows? This could all end at any moment. But that's my hope. What's your?
You're right. Because ultimately, the reason all this is important to public market investors is these companies drive future returns. If you look at what drives returns over any 10 or 20 year time frame in the S&P 500, for example, it's really a handful of companies, and it's usually disruptive technology companies. So it's very important to get these companies public if you're an index investor. This is not an academic discussion because it's just private markets. This is super important to get these companies public. So I also hope we get a raft of new IPOs, and these kind of products continue to fund innovation and get the next raft of companies going that are going to go public in 5 or 10 years. It's a very important process. It's a very important dynamic that only U.S. equity markets really enjoy. This is not a phenomena in Europe or Asia as much as it is here. No. That's why U.S. stocks outperform, is because of this dynamic.
And Rubrik's slated to go public Thursday, right behind me here at the New York Stock Exchange. They're going to raise, I don't know, $750 million or so, but they're not profitable. So to me, this is an interesting test. Here's a big, well-known data company that's going public that's not profitable. So how is the market going to greet that right now? I mean, any thoughts? I'm trying to get this opening up story going in a little more detail.
Right. I think Rubrik will be a very interesting thing to watch because the last two IPOs, you actually had companies that, you know, were somewhat profitable, and they're actually a lot more profitable than, say, for example, Rubrik, which is a most growth-oriented company. So I do think it is interesting to watch what the market reception is when it comes to Rubrik. Do people continue to optimize for growth and less about earnings per share and profitability? So we'll see.
And Brett, you're going to continue to invest in early and late-stage companies. You want to drop any interesting names outside of the obvious, you know, SpaceX names on us that you're particularly interested in these days?
Sure. I mean, we just invested in Figure AI, which is a humanoid robots company. And amongst all the technologies we look at, kind of our robotics forecast has moved forward the most because of the acceleration in artificial intelligence and the capability that that kind of uncovers. So we think it'll be an exciting, you know, business cycle for profound innovation that'll change everybody's lives.
Sounds like an ARK Invest pitch to me. Oh, wait, you are ARK Invest. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Now it's time to round out the conversation with some analysis and perspective to help you better understand ETFs. This is the Markets 102 portion of the podcast. DataTrack's Nicholas Colas continues with us now. Nick, thanks for sticking around. I wonder if you can give me your thoughts on earnings. We're going into the heart of earnings season. And what I've been saying to people is it's important to note the multiples are coming down, but so far there's not earnings estimates. The actual dollar value of these earnings estimates are not coming down yet. Would you agree with that? And how do you assess the state of things right now?
Yeah, no, it's entirely accurate. We have not seen analysts cutting estimates at all. They've been bumping them up a little bit in some quarters and cutting in others, but overall they're still very steady and very good. Earnings growth for the year running 8 or 9%. So there's really not any fear we're going to see a sudden earnings decline. And the first batch of earnings that we saw last week showed us that companies are beating by a little bit more than the average, so that's good. They're not beating revenues by quite as much, so they're doing a good job on cost containment, which again is good. It means that, yes, they see revenues perhaps only in line with expectations, but earnings are still beating by an average amount. That means companies are being very sensitive to keeping their cost structure under control, and that, again, that bodes well for the rest of the year.
Yeah, and cost cutting is a logical reaction when perhaps your revenues are not growing as much as you want to keep the margins up. But nothing beats revenue expansion. That's not quite happening. If you want to complain about something, that's a little bit on the weak side.
Absolutely, but it does set up for a very good back half of the year, because if revenues do begin to reaccelerate, then the cost structures are now very modest, and you get even better upside earnings surprises later on in the year.
And it's important to understand the fundamentals here. The reason earnings are holding up is because the economy is still strong. Is that right?
Entirely.
Riff on that.
Yeah, we're looking for maybe 2.5% GDP growth in Q1 when that number comes out later this month. The economy is still in good shape. Initial jobless claims are still low. Unemployment is still good. Wage growth is still good. All the basic metrics we all look at are still quite nice, quite strong.
And do you feel the main thing, of course, right now is simply Treasury yields, 4.6% on the 10-year. You know, people are complaining, perhaps understandably, about 6 and 7% mortgage rates. But isn't that more normal? That people thought 3% mortgage rates were normal, and they're not. Historically, they never were. And now people, there's all sorts of stories, people don't want to move because they have 3 or 4% mortgage rates. Well, do you think the mortgages are going to go back to 3 or 4%?
Well, let's put it this way. Let's hope they don't. Actually, I'm getting a lot of feedback in my...
Sorry. Go ahead.
So let's... I just popped out.
Go ahead.
So let's put it this way. Let's hope mortgage rates don't go back to 3%, because it'll mean something very bad has happened in the economy or geopolitically, and that rates are coming down a lot. The current level of mortgage rates, I think, are quite healthy. People can still buy a house. They can find one if they like. The prices are higher. The rates are higher. But people have the money to spend in order to afford them. And so net-net, it's not really been an impediment to economic growth.
Yeah. What I say is, I used to be the real estate reporter here 30 years ago, and at that time, in the late 1980s, early 1990s, mortgage rates were in 11%, 10%, 9%, and now people are bitterly complaining about 6 or 7%. That's much more normal historically and healthier. Plus, Treasury yields, we were down at 1% at one point on 10-year Treasury yields. Who's going to lend the government money for 10 years at 1%? That made no economic sense to me at all. At 4.6% there's a positive real yield. That makes some sense to me. You know, that now I can see you being an investor in Treasury bonds, not at 1% though.
So yes, you're right. It's a much healthier market now, much healthier. Having a positive cost of capital is the way capital is supposed to work. You're supposed to get paid for your capital. Even risk-free, you're supposed to get something. Real rates are just back now to where they were in 2005, 6, 7. So we're back to normal levels. We're not at absurdly high levels like in the early 80s. We're back to normal pre-financial crisis levels. It's taken us a long time to get there, but we're here now. I think we're going to stay here for a long time.
You're one of the best data analytics people I know. And for those of you who don't know DataTrek, folks, it's one of the great market reads. I read it every day, and I get a lot of stuff that I don't read every day. So I think very highly of your work, Nick. Artificial intelligence, where do you see that going? You know, in my business, I've been dealing with artificial intelligence for a number of years. There are firms out there that will scrape the data, the economic data of our home sales, for example, right off of the website for the federal government, and will spit out a paragraph on what it's doing in a sub-second interval. And when I look at this stuff, I think to myself, you know, if I only had one paragraph to describe home sales, actually I'd write exactly what this thing is writing, and it's an artificial intelligence. Now, it doesn't have deeper analytical skills that I might have, but you know that's not far away. So I see myself as a financial journalist for 30 years thinking to myself, a lot of this, of what I do, it is already being done by an AI, and more of it will be done in the coming years. What is your thoughts about how AI is going to impact the financial services business?
Yeah, it's definitely having an effect on what I would call the low end. So if you're a rookie journalist, it's going to be tough because AI can be competitive with you. Where it then rewards you is for thinking. It rewards the human for actually doing the deeper analytical work that the AI can't do because it hasn't seen all the things that you and I have seen over the past 30 years. So from that perspective, I think it's very healthy. Broader speaking, AI has to improve productivity growth in this country. That is the central issue. Productivity growth has been very low for the last decade. It's picking up a little bit now. It's been running sub 1%, and that's no good. A country can only be as wealthy as its labor force growth and its productivity growth. If we can improve the second one, we get better economic outcomes.
Explain that to people, because people somehow think, I just want to raise without being able to explain productivity growth to people. We had spurts of productivity growth right in the 1980s and 90s when we had the internet. We had better software as a service program starting to come in. And do you think AI can provide the same spurt that those other developments provided?
Yes, I mean, you're right. If we look at the way computerization came in, PCs came in the early 90s, we had a spurt of higher productivity growth all through the back half of the 1990s, more than 2% productivity growth per year. Excellent result. But since then, we haven't had anything close.
And order, why is that?
You know, there's a bunch of theories. The technologists say we don't measure GDP right. I kind of disagree. I think the central issue is a lot of technology went to entertainment purposes, streaming and games, and that doesn't improve productivity. Now, if we get AI actually in the workplace working to focus on improving productivity, then labor force productivity can finally improve again. But that is the critical issue for AI. If it just proves to be nothing, then we're not going to get that growth.
I remember software as a service in the 90s and the 2000s particularly, when they came in, I mean, it just replaced a lot of back office functions that were redundant. People actually had, you know, accounting books, literally books, that all got automated, essentially. Yep. And that was a huge productivity.
Yes. It went very strong from 95 to 2002. Ironically, it went right through the dot-com bust. All the technology spend was actually well spent, for the most part. But since then, there's been very little incremental productivity growth.
Well, it certainly is a worry that everyone's spending too much time on gaming. I mean, boys in, 20-year-old, 25-year-old boys, 30-year-old boys have spent a good part of their life essentially gaming. And I know people were very worried about that for social purposes. On the other hand, I spent a lot of time in 1965 watching bad science fiction movies from the 50s as a kid, and everybody said my brain was going to rot out. And I don't think it did. I don't know, maybe some people do, but it's a tough game to play. Thank you, Nick. Always a pleasure. That does it for this week's ETF Edge, the podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us again next week for another edition of ETF Edge.
Invesco QQQ believes new innovations create new opportunities. Become an agent of innovation. Invesco QQQ. Invesco Distributors, Inc.